Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S., designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, I want to tell you about a project, new project that launched last week. It's called The Last Column. It's a book and digital campaign that highlights the human cost of reporting the news. The Last Column book, which came out last week, features the 24 final works of journalists killed in the service of news gathering. Daniel Pearl of The Wall Street Journal, Marie Colvin of The Sunday Times of London, Jamal Khashoggi of The Washington Post. There are 24 works in the book, and then a bunch of things that are in addition to the book. There's a mini documentary, a bunch of live events, some educational content that raises awareness of CPJ's work. Go check it out. It's thelastcolumn.com. Thelastcolumn.com. It is a very worthwhile project and worth your time. Here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm your co-host, Evan Ratliff. Here is Aaron Lammer. Here is Max Linsky.
Hi.
Hey, you guys.
How's everyone?
I'm well. I'm doing well.
You're about to go for a weekend away.
I am. I feel well. I'm rested. I feel good.
It's a beautiful day outside. not much of a podcasting day. Who's on the show?
Today on the show, I talked to Kiese Lehmann, who had one of the biggest books out last year. And when I say biggest, I mean it was on every single list of the best books of the year. It's called Heavy. It's a memoir. He also had an essay collection a few years ago, which I highly recommend as well, called How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America. If you look back in the long-form archives, there are old Gawker stories that he wrote. There are ESPN stories that he wrote.
That ESPN Ole Miss story is one of my all-time favorite sports stories.
A really good story. I will say, this is a recommendation I've never given on this podcast, but I would say, I feel like if all Americans had to read Heavy, his most recent memoir, and actually like reflect on it, our country would be a better place. That's the nature of that book.
Is that can they put that on the paperback blurb now?
Yeah, I don't know if I've been the credibility for that.
That was the most blurby thing I've ever heard actually come out of your mouth.
Is there some potential that Evan is just fishing for blurbs?
Yeah, is this like an Oprah thing where you put the blurbs into the universe and the blurbs come back to you for your paperback release?
Bobbing for blurbs.
If you are bobbing for blurbs, no better way to do it than with an email newsletter from MailChimp. You send out some blurbs, other people blurb your newsletter in their newsletter. I don't really know where that was going, but it's a great idea. It's a great way to promote your book. It's a great way to promote your project, and you don't even have to pay up till you get a certain number of subscribers. So thanks to MailChimp.
Yeah, thanks also to MailChimp. They sponsored our live show that we did for Evan's book, The Mastermind.
Out now.
Thank you, MailChimp.
Lots of great blurbs on that one, too. Thanks, MailChimp. Here is Evan with Kiese Lehmann.
Kiese, welcome to the Longform Podcast.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for coming.
All right.
So I'm going to start this. I'm going to tell you a little story,
okay,
which is that I've been reading and digesting a lot of your work. Uh-huh. As I was talking about before, I listened to Heavy, the audiobook, last year. and then, you know, reading old essays, mm-hmm. reading other books, everything. And so I've been very immersed in your work and thinking about a lot, thinking about what we're going to talk about. And I was taking my daughter to daycare this mm-hmm. morning, walking down the street. I'm going to show you this. I walked by a lamppost.
Right.
Look at this.
What the?
It's a lamppost with a picture, your author photo, cut out and taped to the lamppost. I can find no real explanation for why this happened.
What's the other stuff taped on there?
This is, so I took a picture of that too. That's a dog, a missing dog flyer. but that's been there for months. And someone attached this photo.
Dude, that's crazy.
It did get me thinking about, I mean, this book, Heavy, wow. has like, I mean, I've seen it everywhere. I've seen yeah. it on every list. I've seen it winning awards, you name it. And I'm interested in what your life is like right now versus what you expected it to be when you sat down to write that book. Like, great did you question. At some level experience, imagine experiencing this? I mean, your picture being in a lamppost is maybe a little bit random.
Right.
But maybe it's emblematic of something.
It's strange. I mean, I kind of expected people from home to appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know, appreciate it as something to work with. And there, you know, there's some people out there I consider mentors who I really wanted to dig it. But somehow I never imagined just like lots and lots of folks reading this thing, man. Like, and thankfully, I think I didn't imagine it because it's strange, but it's good. You know, I'm glad, you know, much more people than we thought are feeling the book. I'm glad that, you know, people who read and write for a living have found value in the art object. But it's strange, bro. Like, I'm strangely a very private person. You know, I just want my work. I wish my work could walk to all of this shit. I wish my work could come up in here and do this podcast.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? As opposed to me. Like, that picture is just weird, fam. What you just showed me, that picture, like, on a... Because I'm in New York a lot, but I think I intentionally don't understand New York. I don't know how to ride the subway. I get lost walking 2, 3, 4 blocks. So, like, just seeing that picture you just showed me on a light post in some random neighborhood, that's crazy. crazy. So yeah, it's definitely different than I thought, but you can't complain ever about people like wanting to read and feel your work.
And I mean, part of that is the content, especially of Heavy, but also your other work.
Yeah,
it's very personal. And that was kind of going to be my question, is if you had really thought through the audience that it would reach, do you think you would have written a different book?
I mean, I wrote a different book, right? Like, I mean, you know, that's like the third book. You know, it was like the 21st draft that y'all finally saw, but it's like the third book. And the first book was going to be neater. It's going to focus on my mom and my grandmother and my auntie a bit more. And then I just thought, like, you know, I'm from Mississippi. I wanted to do something that was really bluesy and sort of like meta-ish. But yeah, if I knew... I mean, I still wish I could revise this book one more time because I didn't get it, man. I didn't get it all the way right. If I had just like another month, I could have got that thing all the way right.
What do you think was missing?
Well, the last section, just tonally, like, I'm trying to do a whole bunch of stuff in that book, like with tonal shifts. In that last section, I wanted to be much more like expository, like traditionally essayistic. Like, you know, I'm making like proclamations and all that kind of stuff. But I didn't find, like, I'm big on repetition. I didn't, like, find, like, the thing to repeat in the last section. The last section sort of is, like, where the book sort of, like, you know, builds and builds and builds, yeah. and builds and builds to that section. So just tonally, like, I feel like I hit some of those other sections a lot better than I did the last section. But the last part, Bend, I feel like can make people forget that the final chapter really isn't that good. I mean, it's true. You know, you can recover like a bad fourth of a book with like a really good 5 pages. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah, but you're also the only person who sees that. Like, no, I don't think anyone's seeing that.
I think some people see. But you know, this is the thing about writing about this kind of stuff too. I wonder sometimes if people are like reluctant to really tell me what they think doesn't work because it looks like it was a book that was hard. Mm. It looks like, you know, people are always like, oh, you're telling us so much and you're being so vulnerable. So there's a part of me that wonders if people have been reluctant to critique the book structurally because of some of that. But anyway, there's just some holes in it that I see, and I'm gonna work on that, and I'm hopefully I can get it right in my next thing. I just want to create a book one day where I'm just like, yo, that shit is fresh as fuck. Like, the whole joint. I don't need to go back. I don't know if you've ever felt that way about anything. I've never felt that way about any. I felt that way about one piece of writing. It was this piece of writing the Oxford American asked me to do on Outkast. And it was the only piece of writing. And I think I'm like, all right, that's done. You know, whenever I read it the same way. But other than that, I'm always, like, revising, wishing I had a little bit more time.
Well, that that takes me back to the book itself and how you talk about revision. I mean, there's this theme of revision.
Yeah.
And you learning that from your mom at this young age, that that was a requirement in your household.
That was it. Yeah. I mean, at least writerly revision and and I guess behavioral revision in a way. But yeah, like the writerly revision, I mean, you know, she tried to teach me that for years. And when I finally got it, it was just like, I don't know, it's like the first day you do a left-hand layup if you play ball, like that day, you just remember that day for your whole life. I just remember looking at some sentences, and then my mom had been telling me for years, you know, if you just rearrange the sentences using the same words, you get different meanings. Okay. And then one day I did it, and I was just like, oh, shit, like my mama was right. And it just felt so cool, fam, to just like see the meaning of it change. But all of the words are coming from, you know, hopefully some sort of soulful place. But if you change, like, the construction, you change the way they land, too, you know. So I just got, like, obsessed with thinking about the way words and sentences can be conveyed to, like, you know, deflect or welcome or all of that kind of stuff.
But the reason behind your mom sort of pushing you with language, with revision, was, in some sense, it was for protection.
Oh, yeah. In her mind, she thought I'd be less likely to get taken by white supremacy, police, vice lords, folks, you know, these are gangs in Jackson. She thought all of that, you know, if I was really good at reading and writing, and if I dressed really clean, she thought everything would be all right. But I didn't ever understand why she believed that, but... I get it. I get why she believed it now. At the time, it didn't make much sense. Still didn't make much sense, but I still understand why she needs to believe that as a mother of a child. You know what I'm saying? I don't have kids, but shit, if I had kids, I'm going to try to convince myself via them that, you know, doing this will keep you safe, even though I have to know. I don't know if anything can really keep you safe in this culture.
So when you, I mean, the book walks, I mean, it's a memoir, basically, but it's, there's so many layers to it, and so many aspects that I'm sure you've been asked about, you know, a lot of times. But in terms of structurally the approach of it, it's written, it's not a letter, but it's written addressed to to your mother. And so, as I said before we started, I'm like wary of asking you things you've been asked a lot of times. But I'm interested in that structural choice and at what point in the process you hit on that as the answer.
Yeah. So I written this first draft of this book, which was, again, pretty much riding my mother and my grandmother's voice through their experiences with food and weight and sexual violence. And, you know, for understandable reasons, they weren't telling the truth in our interviews and conversations. But, you know, I'm a writer, so, like, you know, people's lives are sometimes much more interesting than the truth. But in writing it, I still needed to show the reader that my parent and my grandparent were lying. And then I was just like, you know, okay, you can do that. But what you aren't doing is you aren't talking about what you've been through. You know, you're using your people's experiences as, like, almost a fucking safari. So then I was like, let me go back and try to redo this book. So then I wrote one section to my mom, one section to my grandma, one section to an imaginary daughter, and one section to an ex-partner. And of all of those sections, the section that was by far the richest and the hardest to write was a section to my mom, just because she taught me to write. She taught me how to protect myself. She taught me how to revise. And we just had the most amount of secrets, and, like, the degree of difficulty in those secrets was just, like, high. So at that point, I was like, I want to write a book to my mama. And it was really important for me that it wasn't a letter. You know, I like the epistolary form a lot, but I think I wanted to push people to think about what it means to not read this as a letter written to somebody, like, dear mama, and, you know, sincerely, KSA, or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted my mama and I wanted our relationship to actually be the center of this book. So at different times, you know, I'm the I, but the you and that space between the I and the you, to me, is the book. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I could do that more if it wasn't, like, a traditional epistolary form. Like, I just feel like I could do it better if it was just, like, there's a you implied here, and this you is the center. This you is actually why I write. This you is why I lie and how I lie. So that's what I did, fam. Like, I just tried to. And also, you know, I've been judging a lot of like nonfiction memoir contests over the past 3 or 4 years. And I just wanted to try beyond trying to like repair a relationship that was like super crucial to me and talk to the world about it. I just wanted to try to write something in a form I hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how it came about. And then my editor, she was cool with it. You know, like, you know, that's what really saved the day, because she could have just been like, nah, this is not what we bought. This is not what I wanted you to do. I don't know if people are going to react to this. This is very strange. And she said the opposite. You know, she was like, oh, wow. Okay. Just keep going. Just keep going. Just keep going. Keep going. And
what had they bought?
What did they buy?
Like, what was
they bought? They bought a weight loss book. It was called 309 Fat Black Memoir. Like, I was supposed to be losing 150 pounds while talking to my mom and my grandmama about their relationships with weight. So, I mean, it was an unhealthy book in the first place. I was gonna lose 150 pounds in like a fucking, I think like 8 months or something. And it was gonna be a failed weight loss book. That I knew that from the jump, and I thought that could be interesting. But, you know, I was trying to write that book I thought people would like, as opposed to trying to write the book that I thought would like save my life and save my family and connect soulfully to a lot of people who I was afraid to connect soulfully to. I think that book would have sold actually a lot, but nothing would have been discovered in that shit. Nothing would have been, you know, it would have been safe.
Well, so much of the, I mean, there's so many aspects of the book, you know, reckoning with different aspects of your life, or whether addiction, or it's not really, whatever you want to call it, whether it's weight loss or gambling or, but weight loss is one of the things that you actually ironic that you were going to write a weight loss book. And then part of what's so compelling about the book you wrote is that it actually more directly addresses why.
Right. I mean, I was going to have to do that in that book, but it would have lacked like just like a oomph, like a soulfulness that I really wanted to get in there. You know, that's the thing about for me writing to my mom is like, when you really write to people close to you, that means you don't have to say certain things, and then it means you do have to say a lot more than you would if you were writing to like a stranger. Mm. And so I just really wanted to talk to her about like, yeah, addiction, you know, weight loss, weight gain addiction. I'll talk to her straight up about like gambling addiction, which is, you know, really like not valuing the shit that you've earned and giving it all away so you can be in a much more precarious situation than you were in. Like, I needed to talk to her about all of that, but I was scared and she was scared, and you know, and I really needed to ask myself how all of the shit we've been going through connected us to the world, because at our worst I felt like it made us feel like we were alone. I think that's what happens to people when you in the depths of that shit, you feel like you're often super alone. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing with so many people feeling the book, I've just been, you know, sadly and amazingly like shocked that so many people are dealing with, obviously, like now, like their own sorts of heaviness.
Yeah.
You know, even people who look super fit, like, you know, want to talk to me about like their issues with weight and food and all of this stuff. So
is that burdensome? Does that become burdensome?
That's a good question. See, I want the answer to be no, but I think it's burdensome. It's a little burdensome, but I just feel like, you know, I'm in that place where I'm from Mississippi. You know, one of the things we have is something called home training, meaning that, like, you know, we're just nice, like, kind, you know, but we're also kind of fucking evil as fuck if you cross us, or we think you crossed us, which makes living down there interesting. I mean, you know, because you're from Atlanta, but, you know, like, some part of me doesn't want to be like, it's burdensome to go out and talk to people about a book. Like, that's beyond first world problems. You know what I'm saying? That's like, it's so burdensome that when I go outside, people want to talk to me about this art I fucking wrote. Oh, I don't want to be that dude. But right now, you know, my fucking body is tired as fuck. You know, I've been driving all these little towns in upstate New York and talking to people who assume they know me, which is wonderful. But yes, part of it is burdensome. But it's mostly wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your first sort of experiences with sort of public writing.
Okay. Because
this incident at Millsaps College is one that comes up in the book, and about you being a newspaper columnist. So talk a little bit about what it was that you were writing that got you in trouble at that time. At that place.
Well, I was 18, then I turned 19, and I was writing lots of satire that was like critiquing neo-Confederacy, traditional Old South stuff, the KA fraternity, Kappa Sigs, just the traditional, like, super wealthy sort of, like, Greek life that was new to me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I had never been around that kind of stuff. I mean, my parents went to Jackson State University, so they, I was used to, like, Black Greek life, but not, like, that very, like, white, literally, like, plantation-type Greek life. And so I used my art to try to critique the influence that Greek life had on my college, influence that Greek life had on, like, the way people contorted their bodies, influence that Greek life had on, you know, what women primarily were experiencing in a lot of those houses, fraternity houses. But it was, like, it was satire. So, like, one, you know, I was playing with voice. So one of the piece I wrote that got me, like, in trouble was, I was acting like, you know, says, while perusing, I remember the line, now I'm not like a dickhead like this, but I remember, like, while perusing a quite engaging collection of layman's terms, I came across the word milsaps or something. And so then I defined milsaps by layman's terms, who was, you know, me.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, 18, 19, big-headed, you know, but also just trying to play with form, dude, and critique what I saw as, like, an abuse of power that was institutionally sanctioned. You know, my president of my college was not a great leader, but he also was a member of one of the fraternities I was critiquing. And so, you know, those fraternities at the time, like, the money they gave to this college kept the college going. It wasn't going to work out, bro. But I did not think I was going to get kicked out of school for what I got kicked out of school for.
Yeah.
You know, I knew I was fighting. You know, I was in for a fight. But I was just like, we just going to have to keep fighting. But you know, I forgot along the way. I was like, you know, like, this is their school. Like, you're not going to win. You can't beat them at their school. They're going to kick you out.
And ultimately, then they found another pretext to do it.
I took a book, took a Red Badge of Courage out of the library without checking it out and brought it back. And they got me on tape, said I stole a book, kicked me out of school.
And what did you, so, I mean, what did that tell you about using your writing to take on power at that time?
That
should
tell me a lot of stuff. But one thing it told me was that white folks were really scared of, like, a 19-year-old who didn't know what the fuck he was doing. Like, that's what I thought was so crazy. I was like, yo, like, I'm just trying some shit, like, in the newspaper right now. You know what I mean? I'm experimenting like kids should at, you know, art at that age. And something I said made them feel, I mean, yeah, I think they didn't like the fact that I was saying it, because I think I went to a school, I know now I went to a school where, you know, if you were black and from Jackson, or you were black period, like, you were supposed to just be happy to be there. You know what I'm saying? Just happy to be there, get your grades, play the fucking sport, you know, smile and shit, go to class. And, you know, I did all of that stuff, but I also wanted to use my art to kind of, like, critique the craziness that I was experiencing. And, I did that, you know. I mean, and the weird thing is, like, you know, had I not gotten kicked out of school, I regret a lot of that stuff. But, you know, sometimes I wonder, would I be here? Because that stuff was very formative. And, like, it's something that I've revised often in my work, you know. So, like, I wrote that essay, How to Steal Yourself and Others in America. And then one of the things I didn't do in that essay was I didn't give the subjectivity of the character who was my partner much breath at all. So I told a portion of the truth, but I also lied because I knew what she experienced. And then I was like, all right, you got to revise that. So when I wrote Heavy, I wanted our relationship to kind of be the center, not like the expulsion and not like the guns and all that kind of stuff, because I already done that, you know. And hopefully not have people be like, oh, I already read this shit, you know, like, I already know what's gonna happen, you know.
Well, that was what was fun about listening to the memoir first,
right,
and then going back and reading a lot of the essays. I had read some of your work, I'd come across at different times, but then seeing pieces of it,
right,
is fascinating to see that it pops up in all these places.
Yeah.
But actually, this is the place where it all sort of comes together.
Absolutely.
But you also, I feel like that idea, that revision idea, the idea that you go back to these stories or your life or things that happened to you and look at them again and try to understand them a different way, or try to figure out what the lie was,
right,
that you were telling the first time.
Right.
Where did that come from in your life? Where did you learn how to do that?
I mean, I wish it was complicated, but my mom. And if I didn't do it, you know, I got whoopings and I got beatings. If I didn't, you know, I tried to revise for years, but I just didn't even understand the concept. Do you know what I'm saying? But my mother was the one who made me. She literally was like, you know, a pointed question. Like, you know, working your text to get a great question is much more important than like a cliched answer. She said that shit to me when I was like 5 or 6. I didn't know what she was talking about. But that's true. You know what I'm saying? It is much more important, I think, to get like a pointed question or two as opposed to like a fluffy, you know, milquetoast cliched answer. So she really pushed me and forced me. And then, you know, I started reading Baldwin and I started reading a lot of bell hooks. And I realized that at the root of all of that shit, like, was a desire for like revision, not just individual revision, but like a communal and ultimately like a structural kind of revision, which necessitates first, honestly assessing the situation so you can see what needs to be revised. And I just think that's the part we aren't really great at as human beings. We're definitely not Americans, right? Like, we don't honestly describe our situation. So then it makes it hard to like effectively revise anything. You know what I'm saying? So I got it from my mama, probably somehow, I'm sure, from like my grandmother's understanding of like radical Christianity, and then from bell hooks and Baldwin specifically.
It's interesting you mentioned bell hooks, because another example that I think is in the essay collection, you have an essay about misogyny.
Right.
And you write in there about, you know, reading bell hooks, reading other feminists, and even being a women's studies right. major, and understanding that material, and then kind of, I don't know, deploying it yeah. in a way yeah. To your advantage,
right.
is sort of how you describe it. I'm not doing it justice, but, and then revisiting that.
Right.
I'm interested in how you get below that first layer. I think a lot of people, myself included, get to that first part where they want to be able to tell everyone that they did something.
Right.
That they know something, that they're aware of something.
Yeah.
But how did you get to that second part where you say, actually, no, the only reason I was doing that was for my own advantage. I wasn't actually understanding.
Yeah. I think it's tough because, I mean, the easy answer is that when your work is being looked at by, I think, the most important black feminist in the world, one, you can't pat yourself on the back for coming to easy conclusions, because your people, your friends, who are some of the most important black feminists in the world, are going to call you out. So I'm saying, like, one way I actually, like, moved beyond just, like, congratulating myself for learning vocabulary was the fact that, like, black feminism and black feminist were not going to have that shit, right? They weren't going to be, okay, great, you know what misogyny means, good for you. You know, so I think part of it is like centering the people who offer sometimes the most abrasive, but also the most like really damning critiques of yourself. Like, you got to put them at the center of your art. Like, that means you can't hide from people who are going to be like, you know, the practice of any sort of like feminist ideology is much more important than like, you know, the theory alone. And the thing is, just like race, you know, like knowing the theory can not just deflect, but also can let people put their guard down and be like, oh, like, you know, he or she or they are one of the good ones, quote unquote. And I didn't realize it at the time, but it is definitely retrospectively. I was like, oh, the few women who actually did like me seemed to like me partially because I liked feminism or I knew the language of feminism. But, you know, once you go beyond knowing the language of feminism, the question still has to be like, how do you divest from investing like so fully in cis heteropatriarchy in every single thing in your life? And I feel like if you don't admit that you fail much more than you succeed, you're gonna fail and you're gonna hurt people. And I think most of us do that, and I failed and I hurt people, and some people hurt me, but I really hurt people who, I hurt a person who would never have hurt me. And I know part of it was because this person thought they were safe because of some of the language and shit I deployed and some of the, you know, clever phraseology and just like ethereal talk of like radical love, but it doesn't really have any legs in real life. Like, you know, great for me, for, I guess, for wanting to feel connected much more to, you know, what the role misogyny had in creating me. But, you know, if you use that shit to harm people who are vulnerable, you're worse than somebody who didn't know it in the first place, I think.
Well, do you ever think about, this is going to come out wrong, because I'm not implying that this is your problem or your fault, but that there might be people that are now using your book in the same way, not the same specific way,
right,
but people using it as a shield in a way?
I mean, you know, that's the thing about any question about people. The answer's got to be yes. Because somebody out there, I'm sure, is using that book as a shield to give the impression that they've done some sort of emotional, cultural, social, political work. And, you know, I don't want that to be the case. I want that to be a book that is really begging us to really consider the limits and lengths of, like, our ability to love. Like, so I'm interested in all of the differences and people have, but, like, I'm interested in, like, how we fail at loving the people we love and what that failure actually does to our body, to our body politic, and that. And so, but yeah, I'm sure people are using that book to, like, I'm sure there's gonna be some dude using that book somewhere, you know. That's the thing about boys, bro. Like, if women just love pineapples, you know, like, motherfuckers is gonna, like, become pineapple connoisseurs the next day, like, to get closer to women, you know. So if there are any women out in the world who like heavy, it's gonna be a motherfucker using heavy to get closer to that woman for sure. At least 100.
All right, so let's go back a little bit. So, because we were starting to just move through your early career a little bit. So you went to Millsaps, and then that incident took place. You got kicked out. You ended up at Jackson State for a little bit, and then you ended up at Oberlin.
Oberlin, yeah.
And so at that point in your, were you interested in pursuing a life of academics and writing? Was that where you sort of dreamed you would end up at that stage?
So that this is in the mid-90s when, like, hip-hop journalism was still a thing. So, like, my dream at that point, by the time I got to Oberlin, I didn't even dream about writing books. I just wanted to write for The Source. I wanted to write for XXL, which came out a few years later. This guy who went to Oberlin, Rob Marriott, helped start XXL. This incredible writer at the time, William Upski, Wimzat, Billy, was also writing for The Source and stuff. So I just wanted to write. I just wanted to be a hip-hop journalist. And part of that was because, this young brother named, well, he was older than me, but he was named Charlie Braxton. He was from Jackson, and he was writing for The Source, and he, you know, he was one of the first people to, like, you know, review ATLians, and he was one of the first people, you know, he stopped Reasonable Doubt from getting 5 mics, and because he thought it was, like, you know, sort of uncritically misogynist. And Charlie was somebody who I was like, oh, yo, we from down here can not only rap if we want to, but we can write about this for a living. So I just wanted to be a hip-hop journalist. And then there was this dude named Calvin Herton, who somebody had told me to go to Oberlin to study with, who was an amazing writer. And he encouraged me to apply to this thing called the Mellon Grant, which was for, like, undergraduate research. And so my mom was a professor, but for some reason, I always just thought of her as a teacher, you know. And so I didn't even understand the difference. And so when I did that Mellon, I was like, yo, I want to be a teacher like my mom now. So I got to shadow some professors on college campuses, and I just got to really dig into Morrison a lot, and Playing in the Dark was out at that time. And I was like, I really want to be a teacher, and, you know, who can maybe write books. And I had never taken a creative writing class, but again, I was writing lots of essays. And at that point, I didn't know you could go to creative writing school for nonfiction. I thought you had to go for fiction or poetry. So I applied to some fiction programs, and I applied to some PhD programs in English, and one of them I got into was Indiana University. Yusef Kumiaka was there. He was an incredible poet at the time. And they were the first ones who called me. So I was just like, okay, I'll come. And that was it. But I still have never taken a creative writing class, even though I teach them. But I, you know, that's another regret I had. Like, I wish I would have taken creative writing at Oberlin. That would have definitely would have helped me a lot.
It seems like it worked out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could have worked out a little faster, bro, to tell you the truth. If I, like, if I had one or two classes, I think it would have helped a lot.
So when you ended up at Vassar after that, teaching at Vassar as a professor.
Yeah.
And when you were saying writing essays, were you sending those out, like submitting those, or were you writing them more for yourself?
Well, I stopped writing essays between like 1997 and probably like 2004 or so. I just was focusing on fiction.
Yeah.
And then after like a few different publishers had the book, and, you know, I got some money for the book, and, you know, it was one publisher was ultimately like, you got to take the racial politics out of the book. Then it became clear to me, like, this book wasn't going to come out when I thought it was going to come out. So then I was just like, let me just go back to trying to write these essays and trying to write this book. And I started trying to write this book to my Uncle Jimmy, and he was getting sick, so I tried to write it to him before he died, but he died before the book was over, and then that book ended up being How to Solo Kill Yourself and Others in America. But I started writing that because I was just sick of what I felt like was like sort of like industry neglect or something for the book. You know what I'm saying? Like, my book was, it was messy, but you know, when somebody buys your book and then they tell you to take the racial politics out of your book, when racial politics are like really important to you.
And America.
Yeah, it could just feel, it just hurt. So I was just like, I'm gonna try to do this other book now. And
how did they say that when they say that? Do they just say it like
they
that?
Said it.
Take the racial politics
I
out.
Wrote an essay called You Are the Second Person, and I had to change a lot of things to try to make, you know, a lot of people not as known as they are. But the quotes that I use in this essay, which are like, you know, coming from a person and people who bought my book, those are quotes from the emails. Like, take the racial politics out of the book. You know, the only way people are going to buy this book is if you can appeal to librarians. The Percy Carter audience, that's who you should be writing to. You don't have the right to write about Katrina. Like, these are like quotes. Those are quotes from editors.
Some editor in New York is telling you you don't have the right.
That's a, but it's not, you know, you want to say that to me, that's fine. Yeah. But the editors had bought the book. And, you know, I was like a young writer who was just like, anything they told me, I would try to do it. You know, like most young writers. Like, if you tell me you want me to move the fucking book out of Mississippi, I'll try. You want me to, you know, change like these two kind of shared consciousness narrators and change them into one? I'll try that. You want me to take the racial politics out of the book? I actually might try that. But then when I think about it and wake up in the morning, I'm going to have to be like, hell no, you know? And that's what happened. And so anyway, I ended up giving them the advance back. And I was just like, fuck it, I'm out here now. What am I going to do? And luckily, you know, Jesmond had just published Where the Line Bleeds a year earlier at Agate. So one of my friends was like, you should just send it to Agate, because if they got Jesmond's work, they might get yours. And so I sent them three books, and they turned two of those books into Long Division, and one of those books they turned into the essay collection, How to Slowly Kill Yourself.
And it's not every day someone shows up with three books.
I know, I sent that shit like Thursday night. I mean, I did that dude a favor, though. I'm going to say that shit loud now. It's the truth. But yeah, I sent it to him like Thursday night, and I think like Monday or Friday, he was like, yeah, let's do it. But he wanted to do it a little differently. And, you know, you sign with those little independent pressures. You know, you don't get much money for it. I think I got like $4,000 or $5,000 or something like that. But yeah, so that's all I got here.
And then after that, you were selling essays and doing even,
yeah.
I don't know if you would call it reported stories, yeah. But you did stories for ESPN.
Yeah.
Where you, about, I love the one about the kid who's trying to make it to the NBA. But he,
DeAndre. That's one of my favorite pieces, man. That's one of my favorite pieces.
There's like, a moment in there where he says, you think ESPN's going to run this? Because I didn't make it to the NBA.
Right.
And you say, well, it's about dreams.
Right.
And it is. That's what the story's about. He's like playing in Mongolia.
Right. He was literally in Mongolia. Literally. But the crazy thing about that was like, man, you know, this dude, this was a kid when I first moved to Poughkeepsie, you know, I saw him grow up. I met him when he was 16. And by the time he goes to play professionally, I think he's like 24, 25, something like that. And we were friends, but he looked at me like I was, no matter what I was, no matter what conversations we had, like I was always the professor. So he assumed like professors also had like some sort of mobility that he didn't. And I did, right? Like when police stopped me and fuck with me, I could pull out a Vassar College ID, which one could argue could defend myself, help defend myself, as opposed to being stopped and not having anything, right? But DeAndre, by the time DeAndre is like 28, I mean, he's been all over the world. And I remember, like, I literally had been, I didn't have a fucking passport. That's what was so crazy. Like, I'm a professor, you know, I'm balling and shit. Everybody like, yo, the professor, blah, blah, blah. DeAndre would be like, man, I think I'm going to go play in Mongolia. You been there? And I'd be like, motherfucker, I've been to Mexico. I've been to Canada. I got a passport to go to Puerto Rico. And then my friend was like, yo, Puerto Rico's a fucking, what do you call it?
Like a territory.
A territory, because you don't need no passport. So then I didn't get a stamp, but then I went to Jamaica and got my first stamp. But anyway, I just thought, I mean, that story is interesting to me for lots of reasons, but one of them is like the way mobility works out in that piece, right? Like he's, this is a dude, you know, who doesn't have college education, but he's got like 50 fucking stamps. And I'm not saying that like stamps equate like should be lauded, but I think it's really interesting the way like, this young man used basketball to see the world. And here I am as a writer who sees the world in a different way but I didn't have the sort of mobility that he assumed I had. And I was embarrassed about that.
Yeah, and he was viewed by some conventional measures as a failure.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
He was telling you, no.
Right.
I'm doing
He's like, I'm living my dream. You know, like, and that's, yeah, and that's the thing I think about a lot of times, like, particularly black boys in basketball, like, we all had massive dreams about, like, wanting to be the best. And, like, yeah, we need to talk about why some of us only dream that way. But what I love about that shit is, like, what does it mean that across this country, like, hundreds of thousands of black boys and black girls now are trying to be the best at something? You know what I'm saying? Like, even I know young writers who aren't even trying to be the best at writing. Like, they're trying to be, like, you know, get their books published. But, you know, I just think sometimes we don't think about, like, the ways, like, people who kind of seem sort of illegible to people actually, like, are dreaming far beyond what most of us even think possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, DeAndre to this day still thinks he gonna make it to the NBA. He's too old. He ain't making it to no fucking NBA ever. I was trying to say that I was a hater. I was being a hater in that thing. I was like, I was trying to say as nicely as I can, fam, like, you not going there. Like, try to do something else. But he was just like, I'm dreaming. I'm doing what, you know, you in class teaching all these white kids every day, trying to encourage them to dream. Fuck, I'm dreaming, you know? So he was right, you know? And I think I was right. I do think you can have multiple dreams. I think you can dream twice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe when he finally runs out of options, right, he'll come up with that.
Right, that's true.
So you mentioned being in Poughkeepsie at that time, and you wrote about that. And when I read some of those essays, like, you wrote an essay for Gawker about the ID, actually, the Vassar ID. And then there's part of me that wondered, like, how did your employers take that? Like, you're not, like, pulling punches when it comes to what it was like to be there.
They weren't too happy with that piece, but... Yeah, that was. I think I regret writing that piece, fam. Like, I was just in it deep with, like, the administration at that institution. And honestly, you know, I did a thing in Portland last year, so I tried some edibles, and the edibles have been helping me sleep whenever I'm in states where they're legal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, yo, if I just would have just had a gummy back then, I would have never written that shit. And that piece reached millions of people, you know? But, and it was written out of something that needed to be written about. Like, I wrote it because little black boys had gone into the library at Vassar with backpacks, and security got called, and then security called police on these black boys. And then the following day, police officers went to the school of one of the black boys and told the black boy never to come back to Vassar. These are little fucking kids. And part of this is, like, I got kicked out of school for taking a book out of the library.
Yeah,
right, part of it
residence.
Is that. Yeah. Absolutely. But I also just was like, yo, this is the I mean, like, it is so blatant. Like, you know, you driving police cars up on the lawn to presumably arrest little black boys who have backpacks who don't go to Vassar. Like, that should be wrong to everybody. And because people didn't find it as wrong as I thought they should have, I just went ham. And I did what I've been doing my whole life, which is, like, when I get sort of not so happy, I start trying to create some sort of art to deal with it. And I just wish I would have dealt with that situation a little differently. I mean, I probably should have written some, but maybe should have written something different than what I wrote. I'm not saying that because of the backlash, but it just made it very hard for me to be in that space post that article.
Mm. You know? In explicit ways?
Oh, of course, man. Yeah. Like, I mean, I mean, they had lots of meetings about, you know, that article was a big deal at that institution. And it went, you know, it was some people's face of Vassar. It was some people's in this country, like, oh, that's Vassar? Like, I might not go there, blah, 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 blah. You know, and that's something we can talk about or not. But yeah, if I could do it all over again, I would write something. But I mean, you can see the beginning of Heavy actually in that essay. But it was the first time I'd actually talked about gambling addiction. So I needed to do that. But you know, man, like, with this book Heavy, like, I felt okay putting it out in the world when I could say I wasn't trying to hurt my mom. I wasn't trying to hurt Vassar. I wasn't trying to hurt anybody in the world with this book. I was trying to love and care and work through shit. Like, and I didn't feel comfortable putting the book out until I could be like, there's no resentment in my heart for... When I published that essay, it was so much resentment in my heart for that institution, and I was trying to hurt them. I don't really think you should create art out of like that, but I don't think you should put art out in the world when you know part of what you're trying to do is hurt.
Even if you're right.
I don't know that I was all the way right, man. I mean, I was right about administration and the way that administration, I think, neglected, like intentionally neglected, like black kids. But there were people on that in that institution who had been doing lots of work to make sure what happened in that library didn't happen. And they didn't really get even like a paragraph. Do you know what I'm saying?
I see, yeah.
Like it reads almost as if like this stuff had happened and there aren't like, you know, committed groups of faculty and people from the community and students who have been fighting this forever. Like you can read it that way because of the way I wrote it, because I was really trying to, you know, shake them into fucking finally doing something. And they did some, you know, performative work like these institutions often do. But ultimately, I regret writing parts of that piece the way I did, you know. I mean, it helped get me too heavy, but it was just, I wasn't thinking through it all, bro. I was kind of fucked up. I was kind of crazy. I just needed to chill the fuck out, fam. Like, in my lifetime, like, even at Millsaps, like, retrospectively, I just wish somebody would have been like, fam, you just need to smoke weed or something just for a second, because you care too much. And I did care way too much.
Well, you mentioned some of the seeds of heavy being, you know, in that essay. And,
right.
And obviously in other essays. I'm a little bit interested in the process of, you know, one of the things that makes a book incredible is the dialogue and the details and what mm-hmm. you capture. Mm-hmm. Did you go back? I know you went back and talked to your mom and and grandma about it, but did you go back to other people? Was there a process where you went to everyone and said, hey, I want to revisit this with you so I can get the details?
Yeah, the revisitation and the revision for me is like, one, it necessitates an initial vision. And the initial vision, again, like I talked about with this other book, but even in that book, I had to spend a lot of physical time in these spaces. So not only did I talk to my friends and ask them what their bodies remember during this memory, like I had to go to parking lots where we frequented or go into houses that we used to be in, go into backyards where pools used to be and try to ask myself what I felt. Like to me, this book is also just like a attempt at sort of braiding tenses. So I wrote the first draft in present tense. I had to write in present tense to try to get the memories right. Then I tried to write in like a future kind of tense. And then I wrote it in past, which was the easier one. And but then like ultimately you have three versions of it and you have to braid them all together in ways that feel, hopefully in ways where like Morrison says, like the language doesn't sweat. You can't really see my hand up in there. But if you look through it, like, you know, the tenses shift at, you know, sort of interesting times. So yeah, so part of that all came from talking to actual people who were there with me. And in situations where I could not talk to people or did not talk to people, but tried to put them in there anyway, there were a few times that people reached out to me and were like, you know, I don't want to be, I hear you writing this book. Don't put me in it. You know, you've done enough damage to me. Keep me out of the book.
And did you heed that when they?
Yes, when they asked them? Absolutely. 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 And then thought a lot about why I thought the right thing to do before was to like, put some of these folks in the book, right? Like, you know, you got to think real, real hard about that kind of stuff. So that doesn't mean everybody who is in the book is happy with how they're rendered. You know what I'm saying? But most of the people that see themselves in the book, I think see themselves, which is what our job should be.
You have your mom's response
right
on your website.
Yeah, it was going to be in the book. And then last second, my mom and editor and me, we all decided it didn't really belong there.
Yeah. Was there any point, I mean, you write about sexual violence, you write about things that are just, they're not just personal, they're self-examining in this way, that were there points where you ever doubted putting that out in the world?
Yeah. I mean, really close to when it was due, that I was like, I can't put it out because it looked different than what y'all saw. You know, it had a lot more things in it that like I could have got arrested for, people I know could have got arrested for, or, you know, there was just a lot of other things in that book initially that the stakes would have been a lot higher for a lot of us. And, you know, nobody wants to go to jail. Everybody wants to keep a job. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But then the lawyers from Scribner go through and they're like, okay, we got to take this out. We got to take this out. We got to move this around. You have to make a composite of this. This can't go. And then I gave it to my mom one more time. And then my mom was like, all right, Key, I really want you to take this out. I really want you. And then, so then you have to go back in there again as an artist and be like, okay, so how can I make it still cohere and really make all that shit that y'all don't want in the book percolate as like some sort of subtext. And so, you know, you have to move shit around and hope that the subtext can carry the day and that people can feel that there's sometimes some stuff that's being hinted at that's not being explained. And I think I do that a few times well, and a few other times I don't do it so well, but that's what I was trying to do.
And when you're doing that, this is a question I know you've been asked a million times, but do you have an audience in mind?
I mean, the first person literally is my mama. Like, yeah. my mama is the first reader. The second, third, fourth, fifth readers are, like, real talk, like Jesmyn Ward, I'm imagining, I'm hoping, and Bell Hooks, who I know has a book and likes the book, thank God now. Like, I was hoping Bell Hooks would see some of her influence in the book. Dream Hampton was somebody I looked up to a lot as a young writer coming up. And I wanted Dream Hampton to feel the book. Imani Perry is the most important intellectual, like, in my life. I wanted her to feel the book. And then, like, just my region, you know what I'm saying? Like, my region and sort of my, like, writerly contemporaries. I wanted them to look at the text and be like, oh, shit, like, KSA did something sort of dope. And then, of course, you know, I had, like, writing teachers who told me I wasn't going to be shit. You know, like, I love the negative inspiration more than the positive, to tell you the truth. Like, you know, I mean, this book, too, is written to some of those fucking editors who were talking that crazy shit to me when I was trying to come up, and they were just pretty much like, no, you know, like, you can't. We don't believe in you. But anyway, whatever, dude. Like, it's all good right now. I'm here. But to me, all of those people they take turns being the front row audience for the day. Whatever it takes to get through my writing routine for the day. And sometimes it takes changing the audience.
And then, did you have a moment when it landed where you thought, oh, shit. Like, I guess you had your mom read it, you had people read it before It came out. But I've never written something like this that's self-examining in this way. And
right.
So I'm just interested in the feeling of starting to see it appear places, you know?
I mean,
people talking about it.
The hard part is, like, I'm a teacher. And so I literally have to put my body in front of a classroom all the time. And, you know, when we were students, this was different time. The internet wasn't popping like it really is, but we still had a lot to say about our teachers and speculated a lot. And so I started to think, I was like, damn, what if one of my teachers wrote a book like this? Like, would it make it harder or easier for me to learn from that person? So that was the main thing that I was like, not sure about. And I'm still honestly not sure about it, right? Like, it's one thing to, like, write this book in the world and know you might read it, or know, like, my mama's friends might read it, or know, like, Boots Riley might read it. But then to think, you know, like, your students or potential people who might not be your students are going to look at this book and decide really about the integrity of what you're trying to teach them, whether or not they will even want to be taught based on it. So I worried a lot about how it would impact the way my students viewed me. And it just came out, so it's too soon for me to really know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the main thing I was really worried about.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things from, like, reading it, it just felt like I did wonder if it was, like, meant for me. Like, there's a difference between, like, gawking at something and, like, processing something that you're reading. And it was very overwhelming at times, sometimes to read it. But then I had other times where I thought, not that it's not right for me to read this, but, like, this was not meant for me, and I'm getting the opportunity to look in on something that I shouldn't be.
Yeah, well, that's part of the read. I mean, that's part of, like, the consumptive experience, right? Like, we all take turns consuming shit that is not for us. And so, or it's not primarily for us. So, like, my attempt when writing this book, was I attempting, you know, like, if I just see you on the street, I'm like, you know, that looks like a cis white dude. I would never have known you were from Atlanta. I would assume you were from Brooklyn. You know, am I writing to, like, traditional cis right, probably politically left-leaning white dudes? They don't really ever get the front row of my audience in this book, but, like, I know that they're watching. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But, like, I'm also trying to talk about, like, the politics of watching, right? The politics of consuming shit that's not necessarily for you. And I just think we talk about readerly, writerly dynamics sort of all feel out about, you know what I mean? Because I read a ton of shit that's not primarily for me. Most of the, you know, comic strips, cartoons. I hear tons of songs that definitely weren't thinking about me. Lots of my friends, black as fuck, love Game of Thrones. You can't tell me that shit was made with us in mind, or maybe it was. I don't fucking know. You make some arguments. Somebody could write a paper about that or something. But we find value in shit that wasn't necessarily built for us. But I think politically, and I think, you know, as a project, I think black and brown writers have to think a lot about what it means to, like, decenter the people and the power we've been taught to center in the writerly process. And it's hard. Because even if you figure out a way to do that in your practice, the reality of it is, like, somebody who looks like you, actually the father, somebody who looks like your father runs CBS, which owns Simon & Schuster, which owns Scribner. So I can not directly address white men, particularly white wealthy men, but white wealthy men sadly have a lot of hands in whether or not my shit gets out, whether or not I get lots of publicity for the book, whether it gets pushed the right way. They don't completely dictate, but their hands are in there.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that's the difference, right? So like, when you write a book, you don't have to really worry about like what black people with power are gonna do with your book. Who knows what the fuck they're gonna do with the book? They don't exist. We don't exist like in mass in the literary community in this country. So I think it's like a blessing that we're able to think about all of these different audiences. But also, I just think it's liberatory to focus on an audience that is different than the audience we were taught to write to our entire lives. And for me, that's what I tried to do. Like, my mom, it's ironic to me that my mama was the woman who taught me how to read. She was the black woman who taught me how to read and write. And in everything I wrote outside of my house, I was taught not to write to my mama. I just think like that's where we are as black writers and black creatives in this country. I mean, literally, because most of our teachers are white.
Right.
Our principals are white. The standards are white. But I wanted to flip that on its head and be like, I'm going to write this book to the person who taught me how to read and write. And yeah, we got some dysfunctional, fucked up shit going on. But we also have like some abundant love shit going on, too. And just hope people can fall into it where they can. That's what I was trying to do.
And did you feel like you got it through that gauntlet, like the gauntlet where the white hands are grabbing at it, that it got to the other end as what you wanted?
Yeah, because that's what I'm trying to say. Like, there's sub, I mean, yes, I mean, there's subtext, fam. Like, you know, people will read this book. All right, when I wrote this book, I never expected people to say, oh my God, is your mother alive, right? Like, but white people continually say that to me. They're like, when I got to the end and I realized your mother was alive, I didn't know what to do. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And he's like, how could you write this when your mom's alive? And I was just like, that's the point. That was the point of that shit. Like, that was the point, right? Like, how do you do this when your mom's alive and you alive? Like, so for them, they read this book where, like, through the whole book, here's this kid writing about his mom who's passed. And
it is like suspense, like, when is she
gonna
die?
Yeah, I'm not trying to, like, isolate all white readers into one glob.
Fair enough. Also, I'm sure I thought
But also, lots of black folks who I know who read the book are just like, I just kept thinking over and over again, what is his mama thinking right now? What is she thinking? You know, those are two completely different responses.
Well, you wrote this essay about Michelle Obama,
yeah,
that was in Vanity Fair, and it talks about speaking in lower frequencies.
Right.
And that's sort of what you're describing.
I mean,
in some
that's
sense.
It. I mean, I think that's the most, I mean, you know, like, I think that's the, I think that was the illest thing Ellison ever wrote when he started talking about, like, who knows what, but when on lower frequencies I speak for you, when he ends Invisible Man. Like, yeah, those lower frequencies exist. We can act like they don't, but, you know, the signifying, like, the private transcripts, like, there's a lot, there's a book within a book within a book. And that's what I write about. Like, I write black books about black books. Like, Long Division is about the making of black books. This book really is about, like, the making of a black book. How to Solely Kill Yourself and Others is also a lots and lots about like black boys and black bodies and black children and black books. And so if you really take books seriously, we know that there's all these registers. And, you know, like somebody who read the book, I guess, or read parts of the book, decided to put my fucking face on a lamppost in Brooklyn. I never anticipated that reader, right? But somehow, some register, that reader got something from it and decided to do that. Or maybe somebody was, you know, who knows why that ended up there. But, like, that's what I love about the writing and readerly process. It's like, you just never know. I never know what the fuck I'm going to write, but I definitely never know how people are going to react to it. Never.
Yeah.
Ever. And that's sort of amazing.
I have one more question on this kind of bent, which is, do white people ask you for or approach you for, like, absolution? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, they did a lot with How to Slowly Kill Yourself.
Yeah.
And, Yeah. I mean, I think, quote unquote, well-meaning white people on book tours, usually older, well-meaning white people, they want you to know they voted for Obama. They want you to know they will vote for Obama again. They want you to know sometimes that the people who raised them and washed their clothes and took care of them were black women. And they want you to, I think, say, like, I understand. It's okay. I'm just the wrong person for that, regardless of race, because I don't feel like it is okay unless we make it okay. You know what I'm saying? I don't feel like shit is, nothing is going to be okay. Everything is going to be more fucked up than it is unless we like double down on trying to make it not fucked up. Everything in this country. So I just can't give anybody absolution, like not even myself. I mean, that book is about like the baiting of absolution over and over again. Here you go, and you're taking it out from people. So I just think it's about like committing to work. But I know that's like what that's like. Like, you know, I'm working on this essay now, and like I was thinking about one of the most hurtful things somebody ever said to me was this woman called me a man, and she was just like, "You're just a man," and I was like, but what? "You're just like a man. You're just like a man." And I just want to be like, "But you know what the fuck can you say?" But like, you know, like, you know, because what I want you to tell me is I'm a special man. I'm not like the other man. And she's like, "No, you're a fucking man, dude. You are a man." That shit hurt me so much. Why? Because it was true. And what I wanted her to tell me was that, like, I'm a man who's trying, who's doing the work, who one day will blah, 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 blah. And why do I want that person to say that shit? So I cannot fucking work on being better today because I got the sanction from somebody who knows yesterday. So I love when white folk come and talk to me, but I'm never giving white people some old absolution shit because I'm not giving myself any.
So, I mean, Heavy has gotten this like critical and as far as I can tell commercial success. It's just everywhere. And you're still teaching, you're teaching at University of Mississippi now. Mm-hmm. And is your trajectory now changed in terms of what you're working on or what you want to do next? Like, do you feel like it's shaping, that success is shaping where you're going, or you're...
I think it should. I think it should shape. Yeah. You know, I've taught every semester of my life since I was 23 going on 24. So I've never taken a semester off of teaching since then. I've just taught. Even when I earned leaves at Vassar, I felt like I still needed to be teaching because I felt like that was too cushy of a job or something. So I know what the healthiest thing for me to do would be like next year, the year after, be like, all right, KSA, maybe take some time off from teaching, just focus on this new novel, just focus on this new sort of form you're trying to work on, like non-fictive form. Maybe, you know, just work on like some television writing you're trying to do. That's what I know I should do, but it's hard for me to not teach. But I know that I'd be better as a writer if I didn't teach. But, you know, also the thing is, you know, when I came to Mississippi, I had other jobs. Like, I could have gone to, like, really prominent schools on the West Coast, really prominent schools on the East Coast. But I went home for a lot of reasons, too. Like, I wanted people to understand that, like, Mississippi doesn't need to be a place you perpetually run away from. Sometimes we need to run to Mississippi in order to create dope shit. And so I didn't just, like, finish that book in Mississippi. Like, I sort of wrote the draft that people see in Mississippi, you know what I mean? Like, which means I really thoroughly revised that book in Mississippi. So I'm in Mississippi now. I actually think I probably need to leave Mississippi for a little while just to get my bearings, man. You know, I'm in the middle of all of this right now. It's hard to see out of it, but I think I just need to go somewhere and just get maybe close to an ocean or some shit, or just get, I just need something. I need a dog or some shit. I just need something to get like some balance right now. Cause I don't know. I don't have like the most balance right now because everything is just coming. Everything is just coming so fast. But I'm super lucky that it's coming at all because we know how that is, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still that writer who like never expects anybody to read anything I write because that's who we all are. You know, you put shit out there and nobody give a fuck. And so when anybody cares, I'm still just weirded out. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm super weirded out when people read my stuff.
Yeah. But I think you always imagine there's some... you would get to some point where enough people praised it,
right,
or it hit the right audience or did what you wanted it to do, that you would then the next time you sat down, you'd just be full of confidence that you would do it again.
Yes.
But then the bar just shit.
Right.
It's just moving around.
It just keeps moving.
Yeah. That's, and there's you can always find some negative thing too. Like
you believe that
your second to last chapter is not strong, which is,
but that's good though, because I can't fix it, but I can fix it in the next book. So that's what helps. That helps me to look at it and see the obvious failures in it.
Well, I hope you'll come back again.
Absolutely.
I hope you'll, next time you got something, anything, or if you're in town, just come by.
Thank y'all. Thank y'all for taking work so seriously and talking about like the creases in it that most people just don't see or find value in. I appreciate that.
Lucky to have you on. The book is amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
That's it for this week's Long Form Podcast. I am your co-host, Evan Ratliff. Thanks to Kiese for stopping in the studio. I really cannot recommend this book more highly. Heavy. If you haven't read it, you should go out and read it and think about it. My co-hosts for the Long Form Podcast are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. Our editor is Janelle Pfeiffer. Our intern is Tyler McCloskey. And our sponsors are Pit Writers and MailChimp. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.